Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to VCOS Radio on Firehouse.com. This is Peter Matthews. I'm one of the editors here. And today we're at the VCOS Symposium in the Sun, and we have a roundtable podcast with several chief officers from around the country. We're going to look at a bunch of different issues facing the Combination Fire Service. First, we have Norvin Collins, a battalion chief with the Tualatin Valley Fire Department, and then we have Jim Harrington with the Gates Fire Department in New York, and also Greg Render, chief of Signal Hills in Illinois. Gentlemen, thank you for joining us. And Norvin, can you tell us a little about yourself and Tualatin Valley?
Sure. Yeah, I'm Norvin Collins. As you mentioned, I've been with Tualatin Valley for about 15 years, in the fire service for 21 years. I've been part of instructing both locally, paramedic schools, and otherwise. I'm a career person with our department. A little bit about Tualatin Valley. We protect 210 square miles, about 450,000 people. We have 350 or so line firefighters, and we vacillate between 75 and 100 volunteers for us. So we're a pretty good size combination department, second largest in the state of Oregon.
Okay, and Jim Harrington.
Hi, good afternoon, Peter. Yeah, my name's Jim Harrington. I'm chief of Gates Fire District, just outside of Rochester, New York. It's a suburban combination department. We run out of three stations, four engine companies, three quints, and two rescues. We've got a 24 career staff membership and about 70 volunteers, and we run about 3,000 calls a year. I've been in the fire service for about 35 years, previously a New York State fire instructor, and my other background, I worked for ISO for about 18 years doing municipal fire evaluations. So it gives a little bit of a background as to my organization, our department, and that's pretty much about it.
Okay. Well, thank you for joining us. And last is Greg Render.
Well, thanks for having me on today, Pete. I'm Greg Render. I'm from the Signal Hill Fire Department in Belleville, Illinois. And Signal Hill is a suburb of St. Louis, Missouri. We're about 5 to 7 miles east of downtown St. Louis. We're a volunteer department. I have 31 active volunteer firefighters, about 22 non-traditional firefighters that contribute to the organization as associate members. We run out of one engine house. We cover 5.67 square miles and about 6,000 people, and we do not do EMS. That's done by private provider, because I know EMS is one of the topics we're going to be talking about today. I'm also one of the lead instructors for the VCOS Beyond Hoses and Helmets Leadership Course, and that's given me an opportunity to go to different parts of the country and hear different things that our listeners are concerned about today.
And I'm sure that the folks that you've met and the departments that you've been able to visit, you've taken back a wealth of knowledge and best practices and maybe not so best practices, and so we look forward to maybe bringing some of those to the table today on the podcast.
Thank you.
The first question, you mentioned EMS, and we're going to look at fire-based EMS. Recently, the IAFC and IFF came out saying that's probably the best means for the fire service, and even during the opening ceremony today, the U.S. Fire Administrator, Kelvin Cochran, had mentioned that as well. So, how, Jim and Norvin, how is EMS affecting your department? Is that increasing your workload? Is it putting a burden on your finances? Can you tell us a little bit about it? And we'll start with Norvin.
Sure. Thanks, Pete. We've been in EMS for quite a while. On the career side, every single one of our companies has at least one paramedic on all of our apparatus out of our 22 stations that we have. We've also made it mandatory that all of our volunteers, when they come in, not only are they trained in fire protection, but they also, within 1 year of coming on with the department, have their EMT basic as part of their requirements to respond on calls for us. Our communities have requested that level of service from us, and that's how we've gone about. We don't provide ambulance transport, but we do provide first response, and while it does increase call volume, it's one other level of customer service we give back to our people that live in our area.
Okay. And Jim Harrington.
Yeah, I got to agree. Similar to what Norm's saying, you know, we're tiered response with our local ambulance. Recently, we had a new medical control director come on staff with us, and we looked at the entire EMD coding system at our 911 center to make a determination as to what type of calls the fire department could have impact with patient care. As we evaluated, again, we're just first responders as EMTs, and we looked at some of the calls that we were responding to and found that it really wasn't necessary for fire department response on those types of calls. So as we worked with the director of the ambulance organization along with our medical control doctor and ourselves, you know, we kind of realigned some of our calls, and so far year to date we've seen somewhat of a decrease of maybe about approximately 100 to 120 calls that, you know, we did not go on previously into 2008. But the intent that we're trying to do is to improve patient care as much as possible by running first responders to specific category type calls in the community.
And what would be the you know, the line that you do respond and they don't respond to?
It's the typical breathing, bleeding, you know, running with AEDs, oxygen therapy, things like that. Okay. So if we can get to the patient, you know, and start an AED and get an airway in them and control bleeding and things of that nature, in addition to some other calls that could improve patient care, we're responding to those. So we do about 1,200, 1,100 EMS calls a year.
Okay. And have you found any resistance from, you know, the firefighters in having to go to EMS runs? I know you do hear from time to time some of the more veteran firefighters who came on when EMS was not even a service that was provided by the fire service, and now it's a mainstay of a majority of the departments out there. Have you had any resistance from the members, and if so, how have you overcome that?
Go ahead, Jim.
Oh, on the career side, that's preconditions of employment is you have to be certified as an EMT.
Okay.
So that's beneficial because obviously it's part of your day-to-day business that you're doing. Our volunteers, as they come into the program, obviously we want to get their Firefighter 1 training in New York State and get that under their belt. And then we kind of push them and promote firefighters on the volunteers to get EMT certification. But have we had any pushback? Yeah, some of the old staples in the organization, you know. We're a fire department. We don't do EMS. But I come back with, well, we're really not a fire department. We're an emergency services organization. If we did fire only, that would be about 12% of our call volumes. It's just strictly fire. So we're a service organization to our customers and our community, and this is the type of service that we're going to provide.
Okay.
I would definitely echo what Jim was commenting on there, that some of the older, more senior firefighters that are there look at it from the, hey, why are we doing this? We signed on to be firefighters. But our cultural standard has always been you're hired to provide emergency services, whether that's rescue, whether it's fire, whether it's EMS. And as we've looked back at our data over the past few years, and it's been fairly consistent across the country, we're at least running 80% of our call volume, 75 to 80% is EMS related, whether it's the heart attack, the geriatric calls, you name it, that's what we're running. The volunteers, when we looked at what standard do we want to set for them EMS wise, we took it to them, said, hey, here's what we're providing in service. How can we better meet those needs? And the volunteer leadership within the organization in the region said they should be EMT first responders or basics. And so we've just locked onto that, and we've let the culture drive the training levels, and it just meets our organizational needs.
Okay. The economy. We're coming up to the end of 2009, and some say that this year hasn't been bad. Next year will be the bad year, and maybe even 2011 before you start to see any recovery in the municipal or local government. Did you have any impact this year, and what are you looking at for the next year to two as you plan out your budget, your staffing, your equipment needs, and such? And Greg, we'll start with you on this one.
Well, I think the economy is, you know, it's one of those universal topics across the board. And when we talk about EMS, as we were just talking about, there are departments around us that have just laid off firefighters. It's affecting how they do their EMS on the career side. In fact, they just announced that they only be responding to life-threatening injuries. Mm-hmm. Because of the cutback in services, no more cuts, breaks, scrapes, or bruises, or those sorts of calls. But obviously internally, we started last year on looking where we can reduce cost at, just for planning to, you know, if we've got a little money in the bank that we can absorb some of those costs. But we've just went through in the entire line item of the budget and looked wherever we could cut cost at, we've done. And we've done a lot of things. We've reduced simple things like turning off Nextels that we weren't using, going to from bottled water on the fire apparatus to the Arctic Boy coolers with paper cups and supply of ice and those sorts of things. And we've also been using for quite a bit of time the joint purchasing or group purchasing with neighboring departments to help reduce cost those ways. And we look for those to continue out for the next couple of years, at least for the short term. But the short term anymore is, you know, the next 6 months to 12 months. But what are we going to do after that? And hopefully the economy will turn around and we'll see what happens next.
Okay. Have you seen a reduction in volunteers in during this time? Is, you know, they're maybe seeking a second job or?
Well, that's one of the things when we go around the country doing Beyond Hoses and Helmets, we talk about recruiting and retention, that the demographics of the volunteer firefighters has certainly changed, that two-income families are certainly the norm now as opposed to what it used to be 25, 30 years ago when it was a one-income family. But as the economy turns down and people are getting laid off, we just did a class up in Michigan, and the auto industry has really been hurt. So the dichotomy here is that these people are out struggling to find work and employment and maybe have to move out of the community. The upside to the volunteer departments up there is they have a daytime response because the people aren't working.
Okay.
All right. So it's a mixed bag on where you're at in the country. And, of course, we would want everybody to be working and find the ways to manage their time to fit in with the volunteer response duties they have back at the fire department.
Okay, Jim.
Yeah, I agree with what Greg's saying. I mean, it's the demographics of the area. We have one small city just north of one of the Finger Lakes that just announced the other day that they're going to be laying off 8 out of 14 firefighters. It'll be 4 next year, 4 the following year. And it used to be the fire service was always the sacred cow, and we would never be touched in the economic environment. But in today's climate, unfortunately, that's not true. So our budget went up 12% for 2010, and the main reason that went up was for personnel, salaries, health care, state retirement for our volunteers, our LOSAP program, that showed an increase. So we've cut a lot on the operational side, and really were very tight from that perspective. But these other things were pretty much mandates that we have to abide by, and there's nothing that we can do with that. Again, as we talk about our volunteers, we just had a recruitment drive in our community with the signs and, you know, numerous contacts with folks on the internet, and we were able to bring on 8 new volunteer firefighters in our community. But again, we're still not meeting those call volume demands, which is requiring us to put one additional firefighter per shift in the fall of next year. So we've had a budget accordingly for that, but also we'll be applying for SAFER grant, which we see that'll be rolling out shortly, and hopefully we can offset some of the expenditures for next year. But it's like I say, it's the fire service again is having to do more with less and finding out in the old vantage what I learned is, you know, what can the market bear financially, and in this case, you know, what do the customers want to bear financially, and the community pretty much is supportive of the direction that we're going, but it's tough to take that hit in the pocketbook for that 12% increase for cost next year. But, you know, it's tough environmental times that we're all dealing with, and, you know, we're doing the best we can to provide that level of service our community is asking for.
And how were you able to increase it, you know, bringing that forward to your commissioners or
With the budget side of it, we worked very closely with the Board of Fire Commissioners along with our treasurer at that point in time. And, you know, as we went through that, we knew we had to make the cuts on the operational side of the house without compromising public safety, obviously, and they were okay with that. But when we were levied with some of the increases on our medical and health costs and things like that, the Board of Fire Commissioners also knew that this is what we're going to have to go with. And, you know, we were not going to compromise the public safety for our community there through reduction of any staff and or through reduction of equipment. Although we have consolidated some equipment, as we did last year, we had three rescue companies. We cut that back to two because we weren't getting that third rescue company to be utilized as it should be. Mm-hmm. So we did consolidate some of the equipment off of one of the rescues, merging on the other two. So we're cost conscious from that standpoint for proper use of equipment.
Okay. And Norvin, how about out in Tualatin Valley?
We're pretty much consistent with the rest of the country in the financial impacts, layoffs, and otherwise. We are fortunate, however, that we have been able to put some money aside, but now with the health care costs coming as an increase, it's hitting us dramatically as well. Greg had mentioned earlier about the types of volunteers and are we able to maintain and recruit volunteers. One of the things that we found in the West that has been consistent across with Beyond Hoses and Helmets is that the demographics of the people that are looking to volunteer have changed a bit in trying to grab the younger group that wants to come in. What kind of benefits do we blend to them? So, you know, a lot of them are looking at the healthcare side of it, looking at not necessarily paid directly as volunteers, but what are the added incentives that bring to the organization, either the educational pieces or whatever. But with having the difficulties in people maintaining jobs, it makes it really difficult to project staffing levels. One of the things that out west that we've done, and it's fairly consistent, and I know that Greg is going to address some of this, but as we hit financial times and looking at producing better government and reducing duplication of efforts, there's mergers that are coming into play. We're looking at merging with some of our neighboring departments just so we can reduce that duplication of effort and provide a better level of service to all the citizens that we respond to.
And you know, people talk about volunteers and they believe that volunteers are free. And so, therefore, we don't have to budget for them. And really, that's a misnomer. Just because we have volunteer staff does not mean that we do not have personnel costs. As Norvin mentioned, we have to equip them, we have to educate them, we have to train them, and we have to maintain them in some sort of retention program to keep them coming around. And Jim had mentioned that he'd recruited eight people last year or this past 6 months or so. And I'm guessing, Jim, probably if you put a per capita cost of that, you're looking at $3,000 to $5,000
yep.
for each one of those volunteers to come on board just to get them responding.
Yep, about $2,800 we estimate.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, looking at that, how do you, you talk about the mergers and stuff. How do you go about that? I mean, what is the merging process? Again, I know duplication of service. You know, maybe there's two stations pretty close to each other, so you reduce the cost there by closing a station in the middle or, you know, realigning that. So how have you gone about that, or what are the plans, and if any of you have been involved in that as well as far as bringing things together? How do you go about that? I mean, how do you know or what process or what formulas do you use to make everything fit into the puzzle?
Well, at Tualatin Valley, we've been fairly fortunate that from the era of Jack Snook to currently with Chief Johnson, we've done a lot of merging and consolidations in the area. And when people look to the fire service and how those come about, those tend to be a couple of the people that hop to the top on how to do that. Basically, one of the things that we do when we're considering merging, whether it's we're actively looking to another area or whether other areas are coming and asking us to provide the services, you have to look at what is the financial impact that it's going to have on you, what kind of reduction in services that you're duplicating. As a special protection district, we protect 10 different cities, so those cities don't have to have the fire department cost. One of the places that we're looking at consolidating or considering is another special protection district. Well, if we can combine under one roof, then we're going to have reduction in the finance department, logistics departments. So it's not just what people would see on the streets with the big red trucks driving around. It's also all the support costs that go into running any large organization.
Okay. All right. And then going to the avenue a lot of departments seem to be going is the mutual aid or automatic aid. So right away off the bat, you're getting an engine or a truck or a rescue or a medic or a chief from your neighboring department. I know all of you are involved in that. So what are some of the best practices that you can share as far as developing a mutually beneficial relationship with your neighbors, but in hopes that you're not always calling them but never helping them in return, or any of the other things, again, through hoses and helmets. Maybe there's some other programs that you've learned about through there. And Craig, I'll let you go with this one first.
Well, we were looked at, when we started an automatic aid on structural response and automatic alarms probably 17, 18 years ago with a neighboring jurisdiction, we were looked upon as being outcast, that we weren't able to take care of our own calls and that sort of thing. And now, 2009, there's not a department in our county that's not doing an automatic aid response with somebody. I would like to say that we are visionaries on that process. Perhaps we were fortunate to see the trends coming and were able to capitalize on that. You know, the whole thing is, in one of the first courses I took at the National Fire Academy, many, many years ago, was incident command. And one of the things that I always remember is the first 5 minutes of an incident makes the next 5 hours. And we can have all the mutual aid we want in 5 hours or 20 minutes or 30 minutes from now, but it's that first 5 minutes that makes a difference. And now we look at things like the rapid intervention teams and how critically important that is to having that first wave of first responders, of firefighters on the scene in the first 5 minutes, in communications with those departments that you're doing the automatic aid with. I've seen success stories where the automatic aid departments, in our example, we joint share equipment, we share the same type of air mask, communication plans, and that sort of thing. And I've seen other places where it's a complete disaster because they just don't communicate the needs or pre-plan the needs up front and on what they expect when departments arrive on the team. And then the training and education component that these same cadre of people come together and train and drill on a regular basis to become proficient with each other's apparatus and know the other people's capabilities and skill levels.
Okay.
Pretty much what we've done up in our department is to implement a automatic aid plan for RIC teams. So the rapid intervention crews, we've been finding that we had some shortcomings with that. Once we roll in and have a confirmed working fire, everybody was tasked with, you know, life safety, property conservation, extinguishment, etc. And the rapid intervention crews were coming in secondary to that. So we worked with County GIS to come up with specific key response areas with our neighbor departments coming out of the City of Rochester, Ridge Road Fire District, and Chalet Fire Department. So on a confirmed working fire, those companies are automatically being dispatched, or if we're receiving multiple calls on that, we'll dispatch those companies. But you know, right away we're pretty much able to hold our own in that first 5 minutes. But I agree, maybe we need to start gazing into the crystal ball a little more and say, let's get you know, the second alarm companies a little closer in and get them ready if they're actually going to be needed. We haven't gone that far at this point in time, but it's something that we are addressing. We're speaking amongst the line officers, you know, within the organization to see how much farther we're going to need to go. Mm-hmm. Our daytime responses, obviously, with our volunteers is somewhat limited because they're all at work. So, you know, if we're going to do it, it should be something we want to do 24/7 and not just the Monday through Friday 9 to type 5 environment. Mm-hmm. So, We're looking at that, but we just did implement the automatic with the rapid intervention crews to the scene right away.
Okay.
One of the other things tying into that, you're talking about station locations, you're talking about automatic aid, you're talking about shared resources, whether it's RIC crews, whether it's rehab crews. The more you can look at regionalizing a lot of your responses, the Portland area, we have one USAR team between the majority of the departments that are there, whether it's the City of Portland, City of Vancouver, just over onto the Washington border side, ourselves, Clackamas County. We've basically made a consortium. Same thing with the water rescue teams. From the volunteer standpoint, they've become specialists in our area because it's a bigger urban area in providing the rehab services. So anything that happens, whether it's a need for air, more bottles, light or heavy rehab, we're able to reach out and have those on automatic aids. So anytime you can regionally provide services, it can help reduce costs for yourselves as well as your neighbors, and that includes training. Western Washington County has put together a bunch of regional training that they can get either basic fire or advanced fire training for upcoming company officers that all the local departments can join into and participate in that training. It's a cost savings from the instructor standpoint, and you're getting increased consistency within the training amongst the region. So when you respond on calls, you know what that level of service is and what the people that are responding from the neighboring departments, you've all trained together and you have a common set of standards.
I also found it the new director of the U.S. Fire Administration spoke to us this morning and mentioned on the grant process that they're going to be looking at things like every fire department does not need a hazmat team or technical rescue, and that the only way they're going to fund some of these grants appears is going to be on a regional basis in a cooperative, collaborative effort.
And going back to the training, you just mentioned that, and Jim as well. What type of training do you provide, or do you have with your neighboring departments as far as making sure everyone's on the same page? Now, Greg, you have the SCBA, so you don't really have to worry about making sure that, you know, during a firefighter down situation, that's already taken care of. That's not really a concern. But, you know, making sure they're on the same page as far as bringing the proper equipment, the proper staffing when, you know, rapid intervention team goes out. I've witnessed an incident where there was a rapid intervention team of mainly rookie firefighters, because those were the only ones that showed up. So they responded, and then it was game on, and a lot of confusion and a lot of hurt feelings after that because of what was provided. It was not fair to the department who would ask for it. So how do you go about the training with your neighboring departments, or even Jim, in your situation, you have three stations. So how do you or three? Correct.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how do you go about?
We have interdepartmental training between the three stations on a monthly basis, so everybody is unified as one cohesive fire force when we're on scene internally. But with our outside or our neighboring departments that are coming on automatic aid, we pretty much just do equipment familiarization. We haven't really done too much hands-on training with neighboring departments, which, again, maybe that's something that we should be addressing, because they'll be coming more and more involved with incidents within our community. So we'd like to be able to see that. But, you know, one of the areas you start talking about training, which I have some concerns with, our new officer development, leadership type training, and that was also spoken about this morning. And those are some of the areas where, you know, I need to start to key into and be able to bring quality officers into the fold and be able to get them training down at the national or at the state fire academies. And again, as a person becomes a leader in an organization, they need to have the skill sets and also have the capabilities and the locations to receive that training. So those are some of the areas that we're working with our local community college and trying to put together some type of a leadership course for entry-level line officers. So that's an area that, you know, we've got to look at. We don't have the magnitude of fires like it did, you know, 30-some years ago when I came in as a volunteer lieutenant. It was like, learn from the other guys who have been down the road, and you're going to get those big fires eventually. But we don't have the big fires like we used to. So the new lieutenants, captains coming in line, don't have that exposure to major fires as some of us old-timers here, if you will, in the organizations. So that's one area that I have some concern with, and kind of where we're guiding our new leaders as they come in.
Okay.
From that standpoint, and this is one of the other things that as a state regulatory agency can do. I know that within the state of Oregon as well as Washington, a lot of times there are state standards that they're setting for each level. And then the local delivery of that training comes out. So it includes the company officers with some minimum qualifications that are recommended. But it's up to, obviously, the individual departments to adopt that. One of the things that can help bring your neighbors together is commonality of your operating protocols. So if you have a consortium of leadership within your region and you talk about common standard operating practices on the fire ground, so you know that we're going to approach the fire the same way strategy and tactics-wise as our neighboring departments is. So if you have what we've called fire rescue protocols, they're very similar to the EMS protocols, but they're specific for fire, and all of the region's areas get together and they have a representative from each of the departments, and so they have input as to how you want to operate on scene. And then you agree to that, it's published, and so everyone works onto that same game plan, so to speak, when you're responding. And some of that can help reduce and improve your operations on the fire ground.
Greg, you're also the chairman of the NFPA 1720 committee, and I'd like to just ask you if you could tell us, a little bit about what 1720 is and what you're, as a committee, looking to do over the next couple of years as you go ahead and revise that.
Well, I've been sitting on the 1720 committee for since 2001, and of course, 1720 is the fire suppression operations, EMS, and special operations to the public by volunteer departments. And in August, I was named chairman of that particular committee. And our next meeting is not scheduled till 2011, but between now and then, we're going to look at the standard. We've got probably two-thirds of the committee is going to be new the next time we meet, and we're going to see what's out there and best practices that we can bring forward to see if we can implement them into that standard to really, make the standard a little stronger and make it so that we're really improving the quality of lives in these communities that are getting fire, EMS, and special operations by volunteers.
Okay. All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners as we wrap up the program?
What a great opportunity to be in Florida at the Symposium in Sun, sponsored by the Volunteer Combination Officer Section of the International Association of Fire Chiefs. If you've never had an opportunity to come down here to be a part of this, it's a great educational environment. It's a great learning environment. And certainly we've had some of the best speakers for the years that I've been coming here, certainly some of the best speakers this year. What an opportunity to hear this morning from the new director of the U.S. Fire Administration, who was here the last 2 years as a speaker, first from Shreveport and then from Atlanta, and now as the director of the U.S. Fire Administration, and some of the vision that he has for the fire service in the United States. And we'd like to encourage the podcast listeners to consider adding the VCUS Symposium in the Sun to their agenda for next year.
Well, I'll echo that because this is my first time in attendance at VCUS. And I'm very impressed with them. I'm getting some good information that I can take back and apply it. And as several of the speakers said today, what you'll learn here, if you don't take back home and share it with your individuals, you're really losing out on what the intent of the VCOS conference is. So we've got two more days to go. I'm looking forward to tomorrow, some very good speakers. So I would highly encourage anybody, mainly chiefs and combination departments, to come down here. Just last night, networking with different fire chiefs from across the country here and actually bouncing a couple ideas off of them. I'm able to make some notes and got some plans already. We're going to make some changes once I get back up home. But it's excellent networking amongst the combination departments. So I highly encourage any administrator in the fire service, fire chiefs from combination departments to come down and try this. It's a very good conference.
Absolutely. That's, couldn't have said it any better than that. Being on the planning committee for this symposium, it's grown. And while we started at the beginning of the year of anticipating a reduction in attendees, I think the quality of the speakers that we've been able to attract, people that have been for years and years, and then our newest, we were able to grow again this year at the symposium. We have more sponsors that people who were able to attend are able to interact with. Additionally, not only is the impact to the U.S. Fire Service, but one of the award recipients is from Canada on some of the awards that were given away today. And then beyond that, we have some guests from Russia that are trying to put together a volunteer system for Russia and felt what a great opportunity to come and learn from the United States Volunteer Fire Service on how to do that. And they're gleaming, making new friends and getting some ideas to take back home to Russia. So it's a fabulous opportunity to network, meet new people, and really bring back the cutting edge of what's out there in the fire service today to your local department and provide better service to them.
And I'm sure all of our listeners know that the volunteer and combination fire departments across the country comprise somewhere between 75 and 80% of the fire departments across the country and protect just volumes and volumes of their citizens. And they're an essential part of our communities. And we have to provide them with a quality learning environment so that they can improve on their leadership skills and abilities to take that back home. And I agree with Jim. Yeah. You're doing a disservice to yourself if you're down here not taking something back home to share.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay. Well, thank you. We'll put links to all of your departments on the website, on the podcast player page, and we'll also have some links to some of the VCOS materials, the reports, the symposium. So thank you again. We have Norvin Collins from the Tualatin Valley Fire Department in Oregon, Jim Harrington from the Gates Fire District in New York, and Greg Render from the Signal Hill Fire Department in Illinois. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.